this is Mina Malapetti with another edition of the Seamless Connection podcast. I am thrilled to have with me today Dr. Saurabh Chandra, the Chief Telehealth Officer at UMC, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. Dr. Chandra, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
You have such a breadth and depth of experience. Number one being you're a doctor twice over from both the MD and PhD perspective, as well as your experience as a critical care physician yourself, as well as working on the administrative and business side of things across a number of health systems. But before we get into that, can you take us back to what brought you into medicine? Did you have a personal story, something that inspired you to do it, or personal experience?
So I grew up in India, and so my entry into medicine probably was influenced by my parents. Both were physicians in India. So from, you know, even a young age, I was always fascinated by what they did. And so the influence was from my parents. So that was the major determinant of why I chose medicine.
What kind of physicians were they?
They were both pathologists.
Interesting.
And they were batchmates.
They were batchmates? Oh, yeah. That's so cute. And it's especially unusual for those in the audience that don't know, for his mom to be a batchmate for his dad. So at that time and in that profession and in that time and space in India. So that is an amazing background. You chose not to go into pathology. So I'm curious about that.
So I think during medical school, I always was drawn towards, hands-on clinical experience. So I did toy with pathology, but always was drawn to having that interaction with patients.
No, and that's fantastic. When you started going into your education here in the US, I will restart that part. When you talk about your journey to the US and what brought you here, can you tell us a little bit about what brought you to the U.S. and then separately, what brought you to where you're practicing today, which was after you did your PhD, but then you continued on in your education to become a practicing physician?
Well, you're taking me down the memory lane. So again, I think, my mom, my dad was a clinical pathologist. My mom switched to being a physician scientist, and she was working as a neuropathologist. She came to the U.S. for her training, and ever since we were kids, I had two other siblings. She always told us to go to the U.S. to get further training, and so we were always inspired by my mom's experience, and my sister and I ended up being here. In the U.S., she was a postdoc and a research scientist at Duke for 25 years. And my brother ended up choosing not to go into biological sciences and medicine. And he was, he ended up being in Canada. So all of us came here inspired by my mom's training and experience here in the United States. And then we stayed back. So that's how we came here. And then again, I was influenced by my mom's career as a physician scientist. And that inspired me to look at medicine in a different way. I was, clinical medicine, of course, I was a passion, but more than that, I was curious about what goes behind every sentence that is written in a medical textbook. And if you think about it, there's like, most of it's based on some body of research, some scientific rigorous inquiry, and a lot of things go into every sentence. So there's a story behind every paragraph of the textbook. So I always was fascinated by that. And so when I came here, I first did my PhD, had a great time, had a great mentor, and then always had in mind to go back in clinical medicine, and so did my research, and then went back into clinical medicine. So had a great journey here in the U.S.
No, that's fantastic. And when you chose, you know, your specialty area, you chose critical care. I'm curious what in particular drew you to that, because that's a very different, much more high speed, less cerebral, academic, I have time to think on my feet kind of situation than what you just described.
I think hopefully my PhD mentor is not listening to this, because I did my research with a world-renowned stem cell biologist, Dr. David Williams. He's the chief of pediatric hematology oncology at Harvard and Boston Children's Hospital. And the whole idea was that I would someday finish my work. I worked with him for 7 years, both as a PhD and then continued some work as a postdoc as well at Cincinnati Children's. And the whole idea was, once I go back into clinical medicine, I would pursue hematology oncology and then have a lab of my own. But during my residency, I just got fascinated by taking care of the sickest patients in the hospital, and was drawn towards critical care. I went to University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, which is one of the top programs in the country, if not the world, for critical care. So shifted gears because was just drawn and about taking care of patients who were really, really, really sick in the hospital.
Yeah. And then apparently you decided that wasn't complicated enough and you wanted to add another challenge of telehealth for these critically ill patients. So what threw that interesting extra level?
And that, I would say, was not planned. The journey till becoming a critical care physician and getting my training was planned. I would be first one to admit that was by chance, by an accident. I was in Cincinnati working as an intensivist, and I had done my internal medicine at a large community hospital in Cincinnati, and they had implemented a tele-ICU program. And one of my mentors there, Dr. Chris Orabella, when he came to know that I had moved back to Cincinnati after my training in Pittsburgh, he reached out to ask me to explore telecritical care and do a couple of shifts at Christ Hospital Cincinnati. And I was very skeptical, like everybody else, that it's such a hands-on, you tend to feel like critical care is such a hands-on field. You are there performing procedures and so active at the bedside. And the whole idea about taking care of the sickest patients in the hospital through telemedicine, through technology, was a difficult to believe in. And he told me, he said, just come and do a couple of shifts. And I still remember going for my very first shift, and on the other side of the camera, 20-bed medical ICU, very severely ill patients. The residents were there, the nurses were there. And I was just amazed about how much data I had. I had access to so much data, not only at the patient level, but I would say at the population level, of how the data for the entire unit, who is the sickest, who is not the sickest, how they're doing on the vent, how many days they're on the vent. So much rich data was available. And then the interactions, the technology, the camera, that you can actually visualize everything that was going on in the patient's room. You could actually focus on the gleidoscope. You could see where the resident was, how they were intubating the patient. You could guide them that while they were performing the procedure. You could focus on the ultrasound machine. You can help them during the procedures. That was such a powerful aha moment for me that I could just, like, it was like, wow, if there's someone on the other end who can do the procedures, you can really help them take care of really sick patients. And not only that, I really enjoyed teaching the residents, having them go to rooms where the patients were sickest on vent, and then talking about, you know, ventilator management or shock. And so it was a very powerful, you know, game changer for me. And I continued to do more shifts there. And eventually it became my passion and became my passion. And I have been, you know, totally passionate about telehealth ever since.
So do you find that the role of telehealth for critical care, is it because it lets you deliver care to places that didn't otherwise have it? Or is it because it lets you treat more patients at once? Or like, what specifically is the draw? And there could be obviously multiple reasons.
Yeah, and there are multiple reasons, but listen, other than, you know, big urban health systems, I mean, the LeapFrog Foundation has come up with recommendations that you should have 24/7 availability of, you know, critical care trained physician. But that's not the reality for most hospitals, health systems in the country. And right. And so the ability to bridge that gap where the intensivist is not available at the bedside, but if there is someone who can take care of the procedures, and sometimes, and you know, depending upon the setting, many times we can call physicians and providers from the emergency department to intubate the patients or perform the procedures. Other times there are hospitalists on the other end who have a good skills for procedures, or advanced practitioners like PAs and NPs who can do the procedure. Then the ability to help take care of critically ill patients where they don't have the expertise at the bedside, I think that was a big factor that drew me to tele-ICU. And even for the system, I can tell you, even when you have intensivists 24/7, I am looking at the population level. They don't have the time to look at how everyone is doing on the ventilator. They're more looking at each and individual patient, but I have access to data. I'm looking at who's ready for the discharge, who's ready to maybe come off the vent, that ability to move the whole unit rather than individual patient to have better outcomes was also a big factor.
Well, and I was going to ask you about that. Have you actually seen, because a lot of people talk about clinical outcomes, financial impacts, right? They all tie together at the end of the day, but they're not able to quantify it. Were you able to successfully quantify it? For example, throughput, right? If you can get a patient off a vent and discharge even a day faster, that's thousands of dollars, yes. right there. So how are you able to quantify that in a way that the rest of the system could understand the value of what you're building? Because what you're talking about, that level of monitoring, the telemetry, is not cheap. So to kind of justify the expense, how did you build a business case for it, I guess I should say?
That's a great question. And I think I'll tell you this, and I'll be honest with you. 10 years ago, when I started working in tele-ICU, we were struggling to demonstrate the financial return of investment. The reason being, it's very difficult to capture those kind of data. You have to, be working closely with the finance people to capture the variable, the fixed costs, and look into all of those things. So, and people still struggle, but there's multiple reasons for that. One is that the data is difficult to get good, solid data about financial outcomes and cost and expense and revenue. But more importantly, there is especially for tele-ICU and now, since telehealth, has there's so much utilization of telehealth. There are so many new platforms that have come up. But I'm talking, pre-pandemic, 10 years ago, when there were only few vendors for tele-ICU, for tele-critical care. That cost for that, just for the vendor, for the licensing part, was exorbitant. So, okay, you can show the revenue, you can show all of that, but when you're looking at your cost and expense and you're looking at your margin, that was, I would say, a monopoly of the market, so to speak. So demonstrating financial return of investment at that time was very difficult. I think a lot of new platforms have come in. So the cost of setting up and implementing and the licensing and software and hardware have significantly come down. So I think this is a new game. But at that time, clinical outcomes were very clearly observed, because you can look at, for example, Apache scores, and you can have, you can measure changes in hospital mortality, ICU mortality, hospital length of stay, ICU length of stay. You can measure length of on the ventilator, complications. So clinical outcomes were very clearly captured. It was very difficult to put the financial ROI in place.
Yes, no, exactly. And that unfortunately, not a whole lot has changed. Except for the most sophisticated systems, it is still really hard for people to understand that cost-benefit analysis when you're talking about so many different variables, like you said, bringing it in. Do you think, and you've worked with a lot of large systems, you've worked at and led a lot of large systems even today, what role does telehealth, and specifically in telecritical care, have to play for smaller systems? Or like you said, the majority of hospitals that can't have an in-person coverage or can't have, all the resources due to budgetary constraints or volume constraints, are usually a combination of the two.
You've asked a question that's very dear to my heart, and I'll tell you, as I said, you can implement tele-ICU in big systems, who can afford those kind of implementation any day. But the question is, can you bring it to smaller hospitals? And I would tell you, just yesterday, we went live with a telecritical care program at one of the smaller hospitals, just 25-bed hospitals in one of the most underserved areas of Mississippi called the Delta region. And the program just went live there. We established another program in a small hospital in another county of Mississippi. So our dream is to actually bring specialty care, not just critical care, but specialty care to smaller hospitals. They are struggling financially. There are so many hospitals, not only in Mississippi, but many, many states, especially in the Southeast region, are struggling financially, are at risk for closing. And a lot has to do with lack of access to specialty care. So yes, so we just brought, that's our determination to bring specialty services, including critical care, to smaller hospitals. Now, I cannot afford, and they cannot afford, to pay for all the bells and whistles. For example, in the tele-ICU setup, we may not be able to provide them a 24/7 access to nurses and pharmacy and that kind of data, robust data, telemetry data that is available with health systems, but we can provide them access to intensivist. And so we have changed the model to have access to a second set of experts, critical care, and it's working. It's working because all they want to do is, of course, instead of hardwire rooms, spending a lot of them, you can have a mobile cart. These are only 25, 30 bed hospitals. You can have the nurse bring the mobile cart to the patient's bedside. You can connect, you can examine with the help of the nurse, and you can have access to their EMR. So it's like a remote consultation. So we remove the bells and expensive bells and whistles, and just said, what is the bare minimum technology and support that we can provide? And it's working.
No, that's fantastic. And, as part of AmplifyMD, that's been our mission for the last few years as well. And that's exactly what you said, which is you strip out the bells and whistles, but you make sure you're delivering that key care.
That's right.
And that's what makes it happen. In terms of looking to where you are today versus where you've been recently, so you led the tele-ICU telehealth program at Northwell, so obviously in a very large urban suburban environment, and you're now leading, taking on the similar role as chief telehealth officer at UMC in Mississippi. So I'm very curious, what brought you from Northwell to UMC, and given how different probably your mission is at both? At the end of the day, it's to deliver care. I completely understand. But the environments that you're delivering care in and the resources you have to deliver that care, at least from the outside in, look like they would be very different.
Yeah. And I think, I had a great time in Northwell. I had a great time. I was there for 6 years and we implemented a lot of programs. Of course, it was the pre-pandemic time. I moved, right during the pandemic. I was there to lead the critical care response through telehealth during the first wave of pandemic there, and came here when the first wave was hitting Mississippi in August 2020. The decision, of course, to move here was made prior to the pandemic. And the primary reason was, so I was there for six years, implemented a lot of programs, not only tele-ICU, but tele-hospitalist, tele-skilled nursing facility, help set up the telestroke program. So basically in an acute care setting and serving, of course, the urban population. And it was always on the back of my mind, like, okay, I've gained so much of experience. How can I demonstrate more value? And maybe always felt that the rural underserved areas where there's such lack of access to primary care physicians, specialists, what if I can bring access to care, bridge that gap through telehealth in these underserved areas, and for a population that's being left behind and are subject to increased health disparities just because they are located in areas that have poor access to physicians. So that drew me to Mississippi, and at that time, UMMC had an opening to lead their Center for Telehealth. We have a rich history of, setting up programs here for last more than two decades. We are pioneers. When people were not even knowing the definition of telehealth, UMMC was recognized the value and was implementing, very innovative telehealth programs. So it was an honor and a privilege. It was a joy to work in Northwell, and it was a pleasure and an honor to lead the program here. And it's been truly, truly rewarding, working here with communities that really need and could really benefit from telehealth.
No, that's fantastic. What is top of mind for you here in terms of your top priorities? What are you focused on delivering to make the most impact for the most patients as you continue to push out care, and specifically it sounds like specialty care through telehealth?
So I love my job here because it allows me to bring telehealth to a wide spectrum of programs in very diverse settings. And let me explain. So the UMMC's Center for Telehealth is also designated as a center of excellence for telehealth by HRSA. There are only two centers of excellence for telehealth that are designated by HRSA in the country. One is ours, and the other is at MUSC in South Carolina. And what it allows us to implement some innovative programs, establish evidence-based best practices, and demonstrate value. So my job here is really one of the best jobs that I could think of, because at one part of my job as a chief telehealth officer is to work closely with different clinical departments and help them further their strategy via telehealth. So it's always, for example, I work with Department of Neurology and we work together to implement. We just implemented a telehealth inpatient telehealth program at a rural hospital, or work with Department of Pediatrics to support rural clinics and further their strategy. So part of my job is working closely with different departments and furthering their strategy. But then the other cool part is where I have flexibility of setting up innovative programs throughout Mississippi and working with our collaborators nationwide to just see how we can implement some pilot projects and demonstrate the value. So yes, I started my journey as a tele-ICU physician, but right now, we are remote patient monitoring is very close to my heart. How to bring value for managing chronic diseases. So another one is virtual nursing. We are implementing AI-based program here in the medical center. So I enjoy telehealth because like this position allows me to delve into 30, 40 different variety of projects at any given time.
No, and the variety is something that always draws me to it as well, which is you never get bored, right? There's always something to look forward to. Last few questions here. I know we're coming up on time. Is one, what are the specialty areas that you find most in need for your community? So in Mississippi, obviously different than in New York, different than for me in California. What do you struggle with the most in terms of access to specialty care?
So, as a critical care physician, I would say, well, this critical care, but no, that's not true. during the pandemic, that was the case. The top most needs that I have heard is number one is cardiology. And there is such a lack of cardiologists and dearth of cardiologists. That's number one. The second, of course, is nephrology that they ask for. A lot of them are asking for nephrology. And then, of course, critical care, not for like acutely ill patients requiring ICU level of care, but sicker patients that would help them prevent unnecessary transfers to a higher level of care, because many times patients may be transferred, and sometimes from Mississippi they are transferred to neighboring Louisiana and as far as Texas, only to be discharged in a couple of days. So if we can prevent those unnecessary transfers, you don't need to put those patients on ventilator or treat shock, and put them on pressors in these smaller hospitals. But there is some patients who can benefit and they're, in between that you can provide them support and expertise. So they are looking for not critical care, but a higher level of expertise that could prevent unnecessary transfers, keep patients in the communities, everybody's happy. So those are the three things that we come across.
And I want to go back to those last two points, because we've seen that as well as when we treat patients at hospitals without the resources on site. It's if a patient ends up getting transferred and then discharged the same day or within 24, 48 hours, it feels like such a waste, right? If they just had that level of knowledge locally. One question, and I want to use nephrology as an example, because you see this with telehealth. It's not a panacea in and of itself, right? It has to be part of the full ecosystem. So for example, with nephrology, a lot of times, there's a patient that's on dialysis that comes in for something totally unrelated, chest pain, for example, but they're scared to keep that patient because they don't know how to manage a dialysis patient inpatient. They don't have an inpatient dialysis. How do you think about that? And how do you help your, partner hospitals, partner sites handle that without investing in a whole new dialysis suite inpatient and making sure that you can get those resources? And like you said, cut that unnecessary transfer, because probably that patient would have been treated and discharged within 24 to 48 hours, well before the 3 days when they would have had to go back to dialysis.
So, I'm not going to name the inventor, but the technology and innovations are moving at such a fast pace that just last week, we implemented the whole idea, Mina, is not to just bring one specialty to these hospitals. The whole idea is that using the same platform, the same technology, but bringing different multi-specialty, giving them access to what they need. I think that's the game-changing strategy. That okay, this hospital if they have access to various specialists, and some hospitals may be needing cardiology more, but if everybody has access to to multi, you know, multi-groups, specialists, that would be the biggest draw to, like, hey, whatever you need at whatever time we can provide you. And of course, you know, your company has access to multiple specialists from different areas. But just talking about nephrology, and you know, we were talking about with a vendor, and they are looking. They are bringing a home dialysis machine into the hospital setting, which would not require a dedicated nurse to handle the dialysis machine. So people are becoming very innovative with the way they use technology, and they have already implemented in multiple sites. So and it's so much cheaper. You can not only use it, the remote nephrologist can place the orders, the nurses don't have to be trained to use these machines. But once you develop the know-how and the skill set, you can even use it so many patients in the outpatient can be brought in for just using that. If they have missed their regular dialysis, they can be brought in and they can have an emergent dialysis using these machines. So there are now innovative ways of being creative to be able to handle sicker patients in these hospitals.
No, I love that, because that creativity is exactly right. They always say that necessity is a mother of invention. Right. So it makes you look around and say, hey, what can I do? How can I do more with less, right?
Absolutely.
So one last question for you, because this is something we see a lot from various sites and various doctors, and I can imagine you see this every day. One of the pushbacks that telehealth gets is that there's a huge burden to it for the remote practicing physicians, right? So in terms of, if you're supporting multiple sites, you have the multiple logins, the multiple VPN, multiple Citrix, trying to build a hub and spoke model, trying to build a situation where you have multiple satellite hospitals benefiting from your concentration of specialists to a broader catchment area. How have you thought about that? And do you feel like that's an area still ripe for improvement? Is that an area where you've seen some options that you like, in terms of just understanding that from a physician perspective? I have repeatedly heard that that is the soul crushing burden of telehealth, if you will.
So absolutely spot on. I think that's a big challenge and big obstacle to wider adoption of telehealth, because the telehealth provider, once you start, I remember my time as a hub and spoke model when I was in tele ICU, we would log into 6 to 8 different EMRs and have them open up at any given time. But that's a big challenge, a big obstacle. You know, usually now we have moved away from a hub and spoke model during the pandemic. Many, even Northwell, many of their providers are now logging in from home. They are allowing, so it's becoming more decentralized. And so it's a big challenge and a big obstacle. And I think a lot of work needs to be done, because, integration of different EMRs, interoperability and using the same platform. I think we need a one platform that integrates with multiple EMRs. And I don't think there is any single platform that is available readily. You still have to go through all the integration steps. So I think a lot of work needs to be done. And the way we are approaching this, we are actually working with the state HIE that has integration at the basic level for admission, discharge, and transfer. So ADT, they have that integration now with majority of the acute care hospitals in Mississippi, almost 85 and 90 hospitals. So we are working with them to increase the integration level of existing integration to allow more data to come through this integration with different. So because they already have that basic integration. And so that is what our strategy is. Utilizing the state, the HIE that exists in the state, increase the level of integration where we can receive, data feeds for labs and documentation. And then the dream is that if there is a platform that sits on that HIE that has integrated now, then we can have a one platform, one login that connects to multiple hospitals. That's a dream. Hopefully we are able to get there in the next few years. But for now, it's still a major challenge.
Well, I know we're at time here, and I want to thank you so much for sharing your dreams, your visions, what you've already done, and you've done so much. And I'm really looking forward to staying in touch and seeing how it develops as you continue to push forward the access to care in Mississippi.
It was my pleasure, Mina.